This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. I'm joined by an amazing all-female team of detectives on an historical adventure to solve crime. We're travelling back in time and across the world to Australia, the US and Britain to reinvestigate the crimes of murderesses from the 19th and 20th centuries. This episode contains material that some listeners might find distressing. We all know the stories of Cinderella and Snow White, evil stepmothers, badly treating their innocent stepdaughters. So, in August 1867, in Kent, in the southeast of England, when an 11-year-old girl fails to return from an evening walk with her stepmother across the lonely wetlands of Romney Marsh, the stepmother has some explaining to do.
The child ran along the bank and fell in. I heard her go in, and I then jumped in to try to save her. I screamed for help, but no one came.
The water in the ditch was only a foot deep. A child of the age of the deceased would have no difficulty in getting out of the water.
She told me, "I wish to get rid of the child before I get home. I hate the very sight of her."
This is Lady Killers, where we re-examine the wild and unthinkable crimes of women from more than 100 years ago. What can their crimes and the times they lived in teach us about women's lives today? This time, I'm investigating the case of Frances Kidder, a 25-year-old woman who's accused of drowning her stepdaughter, Louisa. Is Frances a wicked stepmother, or is she herself the victim of a troubled and violent home? What does her case tell us about family breakdown in the 19th century? And how much has changed today? To find out more, I went with our resident historian, Professor Rosalind Crone of the Open University, to Hythe on the Kent coast. So, Ros, here we are in the absolutely ginormous church of St. Leonard's. It's medieval, it's spectacular. And this is really where our story starts, because it was here on the 1st of February, 1865. This is where Frances Turner got married to William Kidder. Can you tell us a bit about them? Who were they?
I've actually brought with me a copy of a record of their marriage. Frances, we know, was about 22 when she got married to William. And I did a little bit of digging around in the census, and I was able to find a record of her family in New Romney, which is a town just down the coast. And you can see she comes from a very large family.
That's a lot of kids there.
It's a large family, yes. Now, she wasn't in the 1861 census in New Romney. Had to do a bit more digging. And I found her also nearby in Folkestone. Okay. And here she is, Frances Turner, servant. So she's a domestic servant. And it's likely that it is in this position that William Kidder meets her.
And what about him? What was his station in life?
Well, we know he was older than Frances. It's about 15 years older than her. Now, in the various documents, he's described as a greengrocer and a carrier and a potato dealer. So I think we can fairly safely say that he was into vegetables.
But William didn't come willingly to the altar, did he?
That's right. He was a bit of a reluctant groom. Now, I have another thing to show you here. Here's a record of baptism of their daughter, Emma, daughter of William and Frances Kidder, baptised in March. Now, we know that she is born before they get married, so technically she is illegitimate. What seems to have happened is that he got Frances pregnant. She had the child. She would have liked to marry him, but he wasn't really into it. Therefore, she went to the magistrates and she summoned him to try to get the name, his name, on the birth certificate so that then he would be financially responsible for the child. That then encouraged him to, well, walk down the aisle. So basically, it was a shotgun wedding.
Oh, gosh. That's not a great start to a marriage, then.
No, not a good start. And it gets a whole lot worse when Frances and her baby move in with William into his house in Theatre Street, which is just a short walk down the hill.
Oh, let's go see it. So this is Theatre Street. It's very attractive, isn't it? Nice little cottages.
These are lovely Victorian cottages. And I think Frances would have come here and felt like it was a step up in the world. She's no longer working in domestic service. She's no longer stuck in a family home in New Romney with umpteen siblings. But unfortunately, when she gets here, there's a nasty surprise waiting for her.
Ooh.
William had neglected to tell her that he already had two children from a previous relationship with a woman he'd been cohabiting with, Eliza Staples. Now, Eliza Staples had died fairly recently. One of those children had been sent to live with relatives. But when Frances got here, 8-year-old Louisa Kidder was still living with William in the house in Theatre Street.
So does that mean that Frances, who has just become a mother herself for the first time, has also, completely unexpectedly, also become a stepmother?
Yeah, that's right.
That's a lot. How common were stepfamilies in the 19th century?
Stepfamilies today usually come about as the result of divorce or some kind of relationship breakdown. In the 19th century, though, step-parenting was usually the result of death. In the mid-19th century, around 15% of men marrying were widowers and around 9% of women marrying were widows.
So that is an awful lot of stepmothers in society. Is that because these men who'd lost their first wife literally wanted someone to look after the house and the kids?
Yeah, I think that's largely true. But it's also the case that the statistics reveal that children were particularly vulnerable when they had lost their biological mother. And I think it's the combination of these things that give rise to that idea of the evil stepmother in literature and folklore.
Interesting. Now, with me to try to understand the case of Frances Kidder is Dr. Gwen Adshead, for many years a consultant psychiatrist and psychotherapist at Broadmoor Hospital. Welcome, Gwen.
Thank you, Lucy. It's good to be back.
Now, Gwen, if we think about Frances's position, she's, to my mind, horrifically young for all of this. She's at this point just 22, and she's taking on an older husband, a grieving child, and she's got a new baby of her own. And this is a world without health visitors, social workers, social services. This is a household under real pressure, isn't it?
I think it is under pressure, not least of all because this little 8-year-old girl is a complete surprise. She's got a husband and she's got a baby, and now she finds herself mother to a little girl who is not her own. And Louisa is competing with her own baby, Emma. And something between her and Louisa was soured from the beginning.
Under all this strain, William and Frances's relationship goes downhill fast. And very soon, there is discord and violence between them. In November 1865, so that's only 9 months after their marriage, Frances is in court accusing her husband of assaulting her.
On Tuesday, he struck me on the head and knocked me against a shelf, and then he kicked me on the legs. He had his boots on, and on Monday night, he pushed me out of doors in the pouring rain, and I was out all night. Yesterday, after he had received the summons, he knocked me about again and declared he would murder me if I came to the court here today. He tries to starve me and my child.
Gwen, this is very disturbing evidence from Frances. What sort of psychological effects would she be experiencing from domestic abuse like that?
Well, huge grief as much as anything else, and sadness as well as fear. And in that quote, we hear that she's actually worried that he might be going to kill her. And I think Frances shows extraordinary resolve, in fact, in reporting him to the magistrate's court. But one of the things that interests me about this case is about a third of cases of domestic violence start in pregnancy or in the postpartum period. And I wonder if the relationship between William and Frances changes, at least in part, because she is now the mother of a baby and she's not so interested in him anymore. Plus, she's having to look after his little girl, which she didn't sign up for. So I imagine there may be lots of unresolved anger and resentments.
In July 1867, if life isn't bad enough already, Frances falls off her husband's cart while helping him to deliver potatoes. She's badly hurt in this incident. She gets a head injury. I'm feeling pretty sorry for Frances. To help with her recovery from the accident, Frances goes in late August to stay with her parents and siblings on the edge of Romney Marsh, a few miles from Hythe. She takes with her her stepdaughter Louisa, who's now 11, and her own daughter Emma, who's 2. I went to Romney Marsh to find out what happened. I'm standing on a little bridge over a ditch that's full of very green and stagnant water. I'm surrounded by football pitches, and this is a leisure centre today on the edge of the town of New Romley. It's a semi-urban environment, I'd say. You can hear the road, but not so in the 1860s. Then this was proper marshland, and there were big skies, perhaps a sense of beauty, but also, I think, a sense of desolation. It's not far from here that Frances was staying with her family on the 25th of August, 1867. That day, Frances complains of having a headache. She says that she's unable to eat anything. In the evening, though, she goes out for a walk with little Louisa into the marshes. When Frances comes back, her clothes are wet and muddy, and she is alone. Louisa has gone. It's interesting that Frances's parents and her husband William, who's by now turned up, immediately assume that Frances has murdered Louisa. They call the police. A group of volunteers from the local pub go out into the marshes to search for Louisa, and quite soon they find her here in this ditch at Cobb's Bridge. One witness says that there wasn't very much water in the ditch, so little water, that in fact a child of only 4 or 5 would have been able to climb out. Now, Louisa had been 11. A post-mortem confirms that this was death by drowning, and Frances is arrested. The next day, there's an inquest. Frances's parents and her sister Rhoda are called to give their accounts of the evening before. But the most damaging evidence comes from Eliza Evans, a neighbour of Frances's parents. She had tea with Frances on the 24th of August, the day before Louisa disappeared.
She told me, "I wish to get rid of the child before I get home. I hate the very sight of her. And there will be no peace all the time that she is alive. I don't like other people's bastards."
The inquest delivers a verdict of willful murder against Frances. When she appears at the magistrate's court the next day, she pleads not guilty, but she gives a pretty feisty statement.
"I have had no thoughts of doing such a thing as you say. I got as far as Cobb's Bridge and got halfway across it when 2 horses came up, running as fast as they could. The child ran along the bank and fell in. I heard her go in, and I then jumped in to try to save her, but she was further along than where I went in. I screamed for help, but no one came."
And then Frances lashes out at her husband, the one who's had her arrested.
"He always said if he got half a chance he would serve me out and tell any lie against me."
The proceedings are now interrupted because Frances has a series of fits. But nevertheless, she's indicted and sent to Maidstone Jail to await trial. Gwen, there's quite a lot that doesn't add up here, including the fact that this neighbour says that Frances had told her the day before that she was going to get rid of the little girl. Now, if you were going to murder somebody, that doesn't seem like a very good tactic?
In my experience of people who mistreat children, they're often quite overt about it.
No way.
And so it's not unusual for people who've mistreated children to talk about them in very negative ways and often to say things that are hard for other people to take seriously. So when people say, I'll kill him, often the listener doesn't take that seriously. But later on, suddenly you realise what it is that you actually heard.
They meant it?
Yes.
Goodness. Lots to think about. Let's go on with the story. William doesn't visit Frances in prison before her trial. One of Frances's younger sisters, this is Adelaide, now moves in with William to look after Frances's little daughter, Emma. And before long, the gossip is that William is having an affair with Adelaide. She's only 17, he's now 41. I went with Ros Crone to Maidstone to find out what happens to Frances Kidder next. Well, here we are outside the main gate of Maidstone Jail. It's massive, it's intimidating. It rises up above the roofs of the town like a fortress plonked in the middle of the place. While Frances was on remand, local journalists got busy digging into her past. And you've been busy too, haven't you, searching through the local Kent newspaper archives for her. What have you found?
Local newspapers in particular reported on the business of the lowest courts, the petty sessions, the magistrates' courts. And once you start going through these columns, they are an absolute treasure trove of evidence of everyday life, marital discord, neighbourly disputes. And the Kidders, in fact, turn up in these records quite frequently. So, for example, I have this report from 1866, where the headline is actually, "The Kidders Again."
The Kidders Again?
The Kidders Again.
They had a reputation for getting into trouble then.
They did, and probably well deserved. So, for example, here's another one from the end of August in 1865, 6 months after William and Frances were married. And Frances is fined 15 shillings for assaulting her neighbour. And you see this one from December of the same year, and she's accused of breaking the windows of Bertha Potter's house. Another occasion, she pours water down their chimney as well.
Goodness me.
And finally, this one in May 1866. This is where a neighbour, William Henniker, accuses Frances of damaging his property. Now, William Henniker had previously accused Frances of being abusive towards her stepdaughter, Louisa, when he found her covered in blood one day and heard about the rows they were having and actually brought her before the magistrates.
So Frances has got a very bad reputation. She's been in all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, I think the picture that's emerging from these reports is we have this toxic marriage, we have this toxic household, and we also have this toxic neighbourhood, and they all seem to be interrelated.
So Frances is really unpopular. Nobody likes her.
Nobody likes Frances.
Finally, Frances Kidder's trial is on the 12th of March, 1868. She's waited 6 months for this, and it lasts for just 6 hours. There are no eyewitnesses to what actually happened to Louisa at Cobb's Bridge. But another of Frances's sisters, Mary, says that she saw Frances abusing Louisa, and it's very clear that Frances intended to murder her.
On the morning of the 24th of August, she told me that the child would not go back to Hythe again, as she meant to take it out in the fields and drown it in front of the house. She would push it in.
This evidence from Frances's sister is backed up by another witness called Mary Burwell, who moved in with the Kidders for a month to nurse Frances after that accident of falling from the cart.
I saw the prisoner throw the child from one room to another. Another time, I heard a noise as the prisoner was beating the girl, and she came downstairs with her pinafore covered in blood. Often, she gave her no food. I heard the prisoner tell her husband that she would poison or murder the child.
So is the terrible, violent abuse of Louisa the result of Frances's disturbed mind after her head injury? Well, not if William Henniker is to be believed. He's the neighbour who previously reported Frances to the magistrates for beating Louisa. He appears in court to testify that Francis's abuse of Louisa is long-standing.
I lived in the adjoining house for 18 months. I would hear the child being beaten, and she looked much bruised. I heard the prisoner tell the child if she told her father anything, she would break her neck down the stairs. She was frequently turned out of doors on cold nights and would stay in my house.
Oh, poor Louisa. Now, Gwen, a lot of people came forward after Louisa's death to say that Francis had abused her. Great numbers of them. But it seems that only one, this neighbour William Henniker, actually said anything before Louisa died.
Well, I think then as now, I think it's often very difficult for child maltreatment to be reported. So this neighbour is really quite brave. But I think it is also an indicator of just how striking the abuse was, that it was very clear and unmistakable abuse, both emotional and physical, and of course, including neglect.
The judge gives an impartial summing up. He says that the jury should acquit if they have any doubt, but the jury do not. It takes them just 12 minutes to find Francis Kidder guilty. And the judge has no choice but to pass the death sentence. Back at Maidstone Jail, I asked Roz how Francis spent the 3 weeks in the condemned cell before her execution.
She did keep busy. She confessed, and she also had some visits from her parents, from her little girl, Emma. It would have been a heartbreaking scene.
And the execution, it happened outside the walls, is that right? So people could come and watch?
Yeah, that's right. It was a public execution, and people did come and watch. Unfortunately, you could say that Frances didn't die a good death. She relied quite heavily on the chaplain to get her through the ordeal. And the executioner they brought down to do the deed, William Calcraft, the official executioner at this time, he favoured a short drop. And unfortunately, he kind of botched it in this case. And so Frances was left hanging on the end of the rope, choking, and her death was a bit drawn out, which was very unpleasant.
That is horrific.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's really important that we don't shy away from the brutality of executions.
The part that's the most weird for me is the fact that Francis's husband came to watch too.
He did, and that fact was not lost on the newspapers either, who reported his presence. They really drew on the fact that William was this terrible, cruel husband. He was the one who turned her into the police. He refused to pay for a defence, and then he took up with her sister as well. And it was also not lost on the people of Hythe. So the night after the execution, a great big mob gathered and they went down to Theatre Street and they burnt an effigy of William outside his house.
So Gwen, is it the case when somebody's abused, like Frances was by her husband, that then they're more likely to go on to abuse like Frances herself did?
Well, it's undoubtedly the case that where there is domestic violence in a home, there's risk of other kinds of violence, including to the children. I think what's striking about this case, and perhaps one of the reasons that there was some antipathy towards William after the conviction, is that he failed to protect his daughter.
And Gwen, could I ask you, if you, in your own work, were called upon to meet Frances Kidder and to help her, how would you approach that?
It's a very interesting question, and sadly, it's something that I have experience of doing, which is of meeting women who've mistreated children. And the way I usually approach them is to try and find out a little bit more about what this person's early childhood was like. I would like to know quite a lot more about her own experiences as a child.
Yes.
I'd like to know if she was exposed to any kind of domestic violence in her own home, whether she was exposed to physical violence as a child, whether she was exposed to emotional abuse. And I would bet my bottom dollar she was exposed to a great deal of neglect. Frances came from a family with a large number of younger siblings, which makes me suspect that she may have missed out on the kind of care and maternal attention that she would have needed when she became a mother herself.
Let's get Roz into the studio with us as well. Roz, it seems to me the key point in all of this is the moment when Frances insisted that William should marry her after she got pregnant. Ugh, he's obviously a terrible man. Do you think that she felt that the alternative of being an unmarried mother was just too bad to countenance?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. First of all, there's a financial burden. How are you going to pay for this child? And second, there's the shame, the stigma of illegitimacy.
So yeah. Society's attitude towards unmarried mothers is another villain in the piece, if you like.
Yes, absolutely.
How common was it for children to meet violent deaths in the 19th century? How rare an occurrence was this?
Oh, it was really, really common. And especially when we're talking about women as killers of children as well. So the historian Carolyn Connolly, who did a study of 19th century Kent, found that 71% of the victims of female killers were children. Okay. Children were just, they were vulnerable in the 19th century. And this was to do with the fact that there was a great reluctance among lawmakers to regulate the home. That was still seen as a private area that you didn't touch.
So, Roz, is there something in the fairy tales about wicked stepmothers, after all?
Well, yes and no, I would say. It's more appropriate to look across the cases of child killing and think, what is the lowest common denominator? And that is family instability.
Is it the case that that's still true today, Gwen?
Very much so. And it is still the case that of the 100 or so children that are killed each year, the vast majority, some 80, are killed by parents or people in parental roles. But there is nearly always a context of family violence and disturbance and distress that leads up to the killing of a child.
Frances Kidder was a wicked stepmother, and I've little doubt that she did kill Louisa, an unforgivable act. But it's more complicated than that. This was a family breaking down in a time before there were any social services to support victims of domestic violence or neglected, abused children. Louisa didn't stand a chance in that household, but frankly, neither did Frances. Today, we'd hope that Louisa would be removed from the violence and taken into care, and we'd also hope that Frances would get some help into understanding her cruelty towards this child. Is there any light in all of this darkness? Well, perhaps the reaction to Frances's death confirmed the public's increasing distaste for public executions, as they were outlawed by an Act of Parliament just weeks later. And so Frances Kidder has the terrible distinction of being the last woman to be publicly hanged in England. Well, a huge thank you to Dr. Gwen Adshead and to Professor Rosalind Crone. Next time, we'll be joined by Neka Akudolu, KC, a barrister with 20 years' experience. We're taking a peek behind the scenes of Lady Killers. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Jonathan Keeble, and Ruth Sillers. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4, and you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. What can the Lady Killers cases teach us about the authenticity of women's stories? The Open University takes a look at how we can reclaim female voices from history. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.